funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Where's the intersection between real life and art, and how is the creative process different depending on the medium in which an artist is working? Movie audiences may know Eric Bogosian best as the star of 1988's Talk Radio, in which he plays an outspoken AM talk radio host working in Dallas. TV viewers see him weekly as Captain Danny Ross on Law & Order Criminal Intent. But he is also a stage actor, a screenwriter, he wrote Talk Radio, and a novelist. In his latest book, Perforated Heart, he takes on the persona of aging writer Richard Morris, who stumbles upon a cache of journals written nearly 40 years earlier when he first arrived in New York with dreams of changing the literary world. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to be here.
Richard Morris, who's the lead character in Perforated Heart, is really a fascinating guy. He's difficult to like. He is so self-centered that at one point he writes after fighting with his ex-girlfriend, "It hurts me that I could do this to her."
Well, he's very self-centric. I hate falling back into these terms, but he's a narcissist, but isn't every artist, doesn't every artist, and he makes this argument in the course of the book that this is necessary. If he doesn't completely dedicate himself to his work, then he won't be as good a writer as he can be. There's a backstory to that, which is my own personal life. I was just at my eldest son's graduation yesterday. I've been married 30 years. I often, while changing diapers or walking a baby or something, think Philip Roth doesn't walk babies or change diapers. Other artists don't do this level of responsibility. Where's that woman who's just going to serve me? And wouldn't I be able to get a lot more work done if I did that? It always sits there as a problem. Would my work be better? So sometimes when I write a book, or I think almost everything I write is the path not taken.
Yeah.
And this is – Richard is a guy who's doing that life. He's a little bit older than me, but he's a man who all he does is work, fret about his work, fret about whether he's getting written about in the paper or what awards he's getting or not getting. And then he goes his sardonic way with women. He has a young girlfriend, but that doesn't seem to keep him from trying to get his hands on anything that passes by him.
Well, and it's funny when you talk about the path not taken and being served, because multiple times when he's talking about his relationships with women, the first thing he does is describe what this woman does for him and how she sort of fulfills his needs or doesn't, whether she's good at giving a massage or cooking dinner or she's good at sort of praising him for what he's done.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I didn't even notice that in the writing. And but I have that with my writing. I will write something and all I want to do is create the complete world, the universe of this guy as it makes sense to me. Because for me, everything starts with character. I started out as an actor. I wanted at a very young age to be a writer, but it took me a long time to really get into the thick of it. And then I wrote these solo shows, and then I wrote, which I think I did one of my last ones ever on the road here in Dallas about 10 years ago. And then I wrote plays, and now I'm writing these books. And but everything – for me, it's always about create a character and then let that character talk to other characters and find out what they have to say and find out what they're going to do. And you'll find out that in the course of the writing. But my original idea of who is this guy and what is his set of behaviors and so forth is pretty much intuitive. I mean, even the we're in a radio station right now. I set Talk Radio in a radio station. We ended up – when we made the movie, we set it here in Dallas. And after that movie came out, many radio people came to me and said, "Wow, you really nailed the radio. I mean, you must have done so much research." But so much of it was gut for me. It was just like – this must be what it likes. This must be what this guy thinks and the way he behaves. And that's when it stops for me. I go, well, it just makes sense. This is the way I create a character.
What's really cool about this is that this character is ultimately in dialogue with himself because he finds these journals that he wrote when he was just a kid. He had just arrived in New York and wanted to be a writer. Was it harder for you to get back in the mind of somebody who was 20 or 22 and sort of create him knowing that he was going to be the same individual that you were also describing as a 50-something-year-old guy?
Well, it wasn't hard for me to be in that mindset because that's sort of my permanent mindset. I don't think I'm ever going to leave the 22 or maybe 17-year-old mindset. But and the hardest thing was making the transition, showing, because it kind of does show how he becomes the beginning of this guy. By the end of the Young Guys journals, you've seen the events that are going to shape him and push him into the direction, and also a very big decision he makes in terms of his love life to go one way and not the other way. And all of this is going to lead to the older man. This is not really a question, but writing journals and then making them readable and worth reading. I mean, it's easy to write badly, but then it reads badly. So people write their journals in the worst sort of writing. So I had to think to myself, well, this guy's a writer, so he's trying to write as well as he can in his journal. But the original thing that triggered this was my finding my own journals. And I found these journals from the 70s. And first of all, they were when I first got to New York. I was incredibly naive. I was kind of dumb in a way that my general philosophy was trite and not terribly interesting. But even more importantly, everything in my life was so dramatic. And if you think of yourself in your 20s, you don't know the way the story is going to come out. You don't know what's about to happen. So every date you have is, this is going to be, this is the heartbreaker. This is the person I'm going to live with for the rest of my life. Or maybe I'm never going to have anybody in my life again because this girl just blew me off, which happens a couple of times to young Richard. Everybody you meet is very influential, and you hang on there every way, especially older people or people you think are more accomplished. And then particularly for Richard, the career events like having a reading somewhere and it doesn't seem to go over very well. And so am I ever going to really cut it? And I went through a long period like that in the late 70s of struggling to get my work out. And I had to make the work. I had to keep going. But it was pretty clear early on that there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm for what I was doing. It wasn't like it made a lot of sense. There would always be a couple of people, and they would say, oh, man, that was amazing, man. But like then there'd be a lot of people like walking out or whatever.
Well, this character, you know, throughout his early years often compares himself. He lets you know every time he meets a famous writer, he compares himself often to the sort of trajectory that they've had. And I wonder if you think a young writer has to have that sort of hubris in order to do this incredibly risky thing where no matter what you're writing about, you're still putting yourself out there in a big way.
Well, a lot of that's the question that the book kind of poses, but I think the need to write or the urge to get out there as an artist, any artist, is something much more fundamental. It's something where you're not right with the world and you've discovered that making work, and you like to make work, makes you write, right in both ways. But there has to also be an element of ambition, and I think it's naive or looking at the world through rose-colored glasses to believe that artists don't have tremendous ambition, however we define ambition. So once that ambition bug bites you, and I think once you get into the fray, it's going to have to happen because you're going to suddenly be around a lot of other artists who are getting kudos or moving forward in their career, and then you go, well, that guy, how come that guy got the grant and I didn't get the grant? Or that guy got published and I didn't get published. Once that starts to come in, then you, of course, are going to look at the successful people and say, well, what did he do and how did he do it? And there becomes this comparative thing. Ultimately, I think it's part of the mix, but I don't think it's the reason why great artists or good artists make their work. There has to be – it's just a complicated chemistry of what makes an artist – be an artist. In fact, probably a lot of the worst people are spending way too much time thinking about those things. Ultimately, I think the artist's job is to find their song and sing it, whatever it is. And it's a process of time. First, you end up by imitating other people who you admire, and then over time, you go, "Oh, well, there's this thing that I do." You may never find it, but it's refining that. That's what your ultimate goal is.
How does acting help you write, or does it?
Well, acting for me is just a fundamental thing inside of me. I don't I didn't know what it was. I was in a English class in the 10th grade, and the teacher passed out Romeo and Juliet one day and said, "Today we're all going to read parts." And I was given the role of Capulet, and who's the father of Juliet, yells at Juliet a lot for coming home late and hanging out too much. And I just took to it like a fish to water. I actually was a kid who was sent down to the office a little too much, talked too much. I was kind of bright, but I didn't really have anything I did was my thing. I didn't play sports. And when I showed off some kind of ability at acting, then they said, "Well, there's a theater club here at the school. Why don't you join that?" And then suddenly, boom, I was so happy. I was so happy. But I never really trained, or even when I went to school to be an actor, I didn't find the training or any of that. So I'm kind of going off the – so for me, acting is just this core part of me. I think it comes out of fantasizing, of wanting to get outside myself. So I feel like I can just – like some kind of character out of a Terminator movie or something, who just sees the other guy and wants to be that guy and then is that guy. I become other people. So when I'm writing, I just put myself into those people. I become those people, and like I said, I let them talk to each other. Very often they're not nice people, but as Robert De Niro once said, you know, one of the great things about being an actor is you get to be the criminal without the consequences. You don't have to go to jail. You don't have to get bruised up, but you can be a criminal for a day, or bad guy, or whatever.
Are you conscious of writing, not so much even in the screenwriting work, but when you're writing a novel, do you think about writing for the ear because of acting, do you think?
I do. I mean, this is something that gets batted around among writers, to read your stuff out loud while you're working on it. And I'll often do that. I want to hear the lines laid out I want them to sound right, and I will read my work out loud to hear it, to feel that it's balanced and has a nice quality and nice tone to it. I don't really want to be reading my work all the time. I mean, it's one of the great gimmicks of the contemporary literary fiction world, that you write in tremendous isolation and you feel like you've really done this. When you finish the book, it feels like such an accomplishment. And then there's these series of readings you need to do around the country to promote the book. And suddenly you're out there in front of people and you have to face an audience while you're saying these words, something that maybe you weren't planning to do. Certainly in the case of a lot of stuff that I write, I'm not really looking forward to reading some of these passages in front of people. It can be embarrassing. Some of them are. My last book had a lot of really crazy stuff in it. And this doesn't have so much crazy stuff in it, but anyway.
How do you decide what those passages will be?
Well, I go through a little bit of a testing period. There are parts that I like, and then I read them, and then if an audience responds to them, I mean, everybody likes getting a response. So when you do a reading, you after a while you gravitate towards the selections that are getting the best response. Right now, it seems that there's two dialogues between Richard and two exes of his. One is a woman he lived with for 15 years. Another is an ex-roommate of his who he had these sort of affairs with when he was living with her. And
there's the music. We'll take
a
quick
break.
But just, you can wrap up your thought.
Oh, well, it's just that when I play the woman and I play Richard as I'm reading it, that seems to tickle everyone's fancy.
Eric Bogosian is my guest. We're talking about his career as a writer and actor and his new novel, Perforated Heart.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
When we are in sync with the universe, we call this being harmonious. When we are out of sync with the universe, we call this being alienated. We are either harmonious or we are alienated. How do we know which state we are in? We just know. So let us now clear our minds and still our centers, and let us contemplate these two states of being, harmony and alienation. I am warm, I am happy, I am harmonious. I am cold, I am angry, I am alienated. I am swimming in my heated swimming pool. I am harmonious. I am doing my taxes. I am alienated. I am buying a brand new Lexus with all leather interior. I am harmonious. I am working three jobs to pay for dental insurance. I am alienated. I am flying first class to St. Bart's. I am harmonious. I am going to jail for food stamp fraud. I am alienated. If we carefully examine these two states of being, a deep and abiding spiritual principle becomes obvious. Alienation is simply a lack of money.
That is Eric Bogosian performing Wake Up and Smell the Coffee. He is my guest today. We're talking about his work as a writer and actor, his new novel, Perforated Heart. From what I understand, when you do these one-man shows, you don't bring props or costumes or anything. It's just you.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I don't do them anymore. Mm-hmm. I think one of my last performances was actually here in Dallas a while ago. But the idea was originally to use, again, the core skill set of being an actor to do the thing that I think is most magical about acting, which is you can have a person standing in front of you and you know that that guy is just some guy, he's an actor, and yet using whatever it is that an actor can do in front of an audience, you start to believe that the other guy is actually there, that this guy is here, the harmonious guy is actually standing in front of you telling you these things. And Gabriel Byrne said something in an interview just the other day. I think it was actually on one of these networks. And he said, there's this magical thing that happens in acting where almost – it seems like almost your thoughts can be read by an audience if you are completely immersed in character. I'm fascinated by that. I think it is magical. I don't understand it. And the first one-person shows that I did were all about shifting from one character to another as rapidly as possible. Not doing lots and lots of characters, but simply the speed at which I went from one character to another in a split second to show the audience that this is – I don't even know how it works. It's just – if you can do it, you can do it. And what does that say about who we are on a day-to-day basis anyway to each other? Because in a way we are always presenting ourselves as the character that we play ourselves. But that character is not a consistent character. We act very differently around our parents than we do around our buddies at the pool hall or around our employer. So we have some control over our character. And I just think all of this is very fundamental. And I feel lucky to be an actor so that I can go exploring and trips. And of course, from the clip everybody just heard, I'm interested in humor and trying to slide in some kind of message there. Like I said, I don't do those. I made six of those shows. They were off Broadway over 20 years. And then I just felt like I had worked that thing to nth degree. Now, if there's a play for me to be in, I'll be in a play, or I might not have my job in Law and Order. Just different now.
Is it hard for you to understand why so many people can't act? I mean, people may act different in front of their parents than they do at work and with their friends, but, you know, a lot of people try acting and are really horrible at it.
I know that people can't do it. I don't know why, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's even a genetic component to it. I mean, I'm Armenian. We are a fairly histrionic, mercurial group of people, and maybe that emphatic quality makes you a better actor. I mean, there's a lot of great Italian actors, Irish actors, Jewish actors. Those are all very emphatic people. But then I guess you could keep saying that about all sorts of people, right? French people, German people, Polish people, they're all great actors there too. I don't know why one person can or can't. I know that for me, when I was little, I spent a lot of time by myself, and my best friend was the guy in the mirror in my bedroom, and I spent a lot of time talking to him and making faces and pretend. And I'd spent a lot of time pretending. Pretending was a really was very important for me to get through the day. So I had all these sort of. I remember seeing Lawrence of Arabia, and I was probably 7 years old, and I spent the entire afternoon running around the backyard with a sheet racing around. And I had become Lawrence of Arabia going over the sand dunes. And I don't know. I don't know what happens when somebody else gets to pretend. But for me, it was extremely sustaining when I was small to go into that fantasy world. And it's probably like a muscle that got built up over time.
Is that easier than writing?
Yeah. Yeah. Writing for me is really hard work. I think I'm a natural-born actor. I don't think I'm a natural-born writer. But there are some things you can learn. I've always been a very big reader. I think I'm a good reader. I know what I like and what I don't like. One of the key things for me anyway as a writer is to take the work and put it aside for a while and then return to it and read it maybe with fresh eyes and say, does this really work or doesn't it? And then be willing to edit. I think one of the hardest things for any writer is to spend a lot of time on anything, a short story or a passage, and then realize it just doesn't work.
Because it's precious to you because you made it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you want to say to everybody, hey, I rewrote this 25 times. It's good, but sometimes it's not. And to be able to say, this isn't good. This has to be changed. This book was somewhere around 800 or something pages, and it's now around 300 pages. For me, whatever it takes, it's going to take. And if that's what I have to do to work on it, to get it down to the parts that I find good and not just acceptable, but good to read, then that's what I'll do.
Eric Bogosian is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes. I was curious, as a writer and actor, is there anything about human nature that you would like your audience to know? And I suppose this is the same question that Gene Siskel used to ask of his interviewees, which is, what do you know for sure about human nature? Thank you.
Well, I go exploring around the parts of my own personal human nature that puzzle me or disappoint me, where there's a big question mark. I mean, even the little passage that just got played of the sort of new agey guru guy, that started when I was watching Deepak Chopra on some special on TV, and I found myself completely sucked in.
It was probably PBS.
Yes. It was like a benefit thing or something. And I got completely sucked in. That interested me because I'm not that kind of person at all to be sucked into that. And I was watching myself getting sucked in, and I thought, why is this guy so charismatic? How is this guy able to do this to me? And that was what prompted me to go and work on that character. He ended up becoming he has a comedic punchline, but I was very interested in his charisma as well, and that's what I wanted to look at. So I work on the foibles and the defects of my own character or characters or people. I am highly suspicious of anybody who presents themselves as having none and a sort of a saint. I don't think anybody is a saint. And if there was anything I would say, I mean, I don't really write my stuff for anybody to come away with any kind of message, but we all have faults, and you got to be tolerant, and maybe it's a good idea to try to look at things from the other side. Also, writing is a contrivance. It's not real. I didn't make Richard Morris and then put him out into the real world. There is no real Richard Morris. He's a contrivance in a book who's there for us to look at and have fun with reading. And as far as I know, the history of Western civilization focuses on problematic characters, whether it's Macbeth or Raskolnikov or whoever it might be. These aren't guys that you want to have as best friends. They're people who the author thinks is somebody worth looking at because we have those feelings in ourselves of ambition or greed or fear or whatever it might be. And then hopefully you read it and you go, ah, that's resonating with me, and now I'm inside it for a while, and I can really explore it while I read this book.
He's also dealing with the potential of his own mortality, and it, you know, sort of early on in the book, a kind of a distant relative dies, and then he feels sort of separated from it, and then all of a sudden he's right there having to think about that. Is that something that you've experienced firsthand?
Well, the passages later, he gets involved with his father, who's very ill, and mm-hmm. his father is got some kind of mixture of, which happens with older folks, of being physically sick, but also seems to have some sort of Alzheimer's as well. Something like that happened with my own dad, but actually happened after I started writing those passages in the book, which was kind of crazy.
That's got to be unsettling.
Well, it is. And for anybody who's – oh, there's been other parallels. I usually sit down and write, and then everything starts happening after I write it. But anyone who's taking care of a sick parent or a parent with dementia or something, it starts immediately reflecting on your own self. You're going, oh, okay, so is this where I'm going to be 25 years from now? That's not going to be good. I don't want this to happen. So, it is part of my life. I think it's part of anybody who's in their 50s starts looking around. And you're at a point in your life where a lot of things that you were looking forward to are behind you. You know, you've done it. You graduated high school, college, you got the job, maybe you succeeded at the job, whatever it is. So now what happens? Or in like my case, I have empty nests coming up this fall. Both my kids will be out of the house. And that is another one of those milestones. So I also think, though, in terms of the overall theme of the book, and I don't even know what that is really, but the fact that he's an artist, the mortality plays big time, because artists, especially this guy who has no kids and has no other life than the writing that he does, feels that his writing is his children, and this is what he's got that's gonna be left behind. What at some point in everyone's life you do think about, what sort of impression have I made on the world on any level, as a parent or as a friend or anything, or as an artist? And if you think you haven't made any impression on the world at all, that you've been passing through this world completely invisible and unnoticed, that I think is a enormously frightening prospect, especially as you come to the realization that you will not be here someday. And then, so what was it? It was just a sort of anonymous thing. These are big questions, and I don't pretend to try to answer them, but these are things that I do that pass through my thoughts, and they imbue the book, and they're part of it too.
Well, one big source of irritation for him is that he's written 25 years ago this collection of short stories, and that's always, you know, the apposition right after his name is explaining those stories. Do you relate to that because of talk radio? I mean, obviously, you're still working, you're still out there, you're still producing, but that's always the way. I did it this morning, this afternoon in the introduction. People say, and you definitely know him from talk radio.
Yeah, it's not talk radio that did it, though. You mentioned the other thing, which was the solo stuff. And those monologue shows have now become sort of – if you're in the theater department anywhere in the country, you're going to end up reading these monologues, because they're very convenient for teachers to give to kids. They're short, and they are appealing because they have humor in them, or whatever the reasons are. And maybe because they're actually good. But they do chase me, because I did write them. Some of them I wrote a long time ago, and it's like I do other things. Okay, I write plays, I write novels. So yeah, there's a parallel between me and the way he feels about his short stories. But I think that would be true. An artist likes to believe in their heart that they make things because that their success is due to their huge skill and ability. But sometimes it's about the fact that they happen to be there at the right time. They were writing the thing that people wanted to read at that moment. And so when they try to repeat success later, they don't have any control over all these different things. I mean, one of the things about my work, not to put my stuff down, but my work came out of a very, very angry place in the late 70s and the early 80s. Being really angry became very fashionable in the 80s. And so things like the play talk radio and the movie talk radio and the solo stuff I did, which was extremely aggressive and which I saw as coming out of the punk rock scene, was like fashionable. And maybe there was like another thing to come later. I mean, my work has nothing to do with some of the writing that has been really cool in the last, let's say, 15 years, David Foster Wallace, or something that's completely different, or magical realism. I have nothing to do with that kind of stuff. So I want to say, hey, wait a minute, everybody. I'm still here. Look, I'm writing and I'm doing the best I can. That happens for anybody who has early success. You then, as an artist, have a new challenge, which is don't try to repeat that stuff, because if you do, you're going to be trapped. And also, don't try to take the temperature of your audience and figure out what they want, because when you start doing that, which is another – I mean, that can work kind of for a while, but if you do too much of that, you're just going to dilute your point of view, and you're not going to make good work ultimately. You may actually make something that's very, very popular, but you'll ultimately be selling your work down the road. You got to stick with the hardest thing of all, which is how do I get my point of view out and onto the page and communicate it to other people? And it may mean that you go into a very lonely place for a while. Philip Roth is one of my heroes as a writer, and I think that he definitely went through a very dark period in the middle of his career around the novel Operation Shylock, in which he was just – it seemed like the world was sort of turning away from him. And he pushed onward and ended up making his best work over the next 15 years after that book.
Eric Bogosian is my guest. We are talking about his work as a writer and actor. His new novel is called Perforated Heart, and he's in town for a writer's studio appearance in Dallas.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Is rotten to the core, and somebody better do something about it. I want you to take your hand out of that bowl of Fritos, throw away your National Enquirer, and pick up the phone. Go ahead, pick it up, hold it up to your face, and dial 555-TALK. Open your mouth and tell me what we're going to do about the mess this country's in. Talk radio. It's the last neighborhood in town. People just don't talk to each other anymore. Let's go to the first caller. Night Talk, Agnes. Yeah.
I love Lucy. Now, why don't they make more of them?
Those shows are ancient, Agnes. Lucille Ball must be at least 105 years old. The rest of the cast is dead.
That, again, is Eric Bogosian in a clip from Talk Radio in 1988, a very different kind of Dallas talk radio station than the one you're listening to right now. Did you listen to a lot of talk radio? Do you find it entertaining?
I did listen to a lot of talk radio when I was writing the play. I would actually listen all across the country. I was fascinated by the fact that a voice could have so much – make such a big impression on people. And also in those days – this was the first wave of these guys, and there was another second wave of these guys 20 years later. But the financial consultant guys who really had nothing nothing constructive to tell anybody, but I mean, I think some of these guys went to jail. Then there were these highly opinionated guys out of New York. This is before people make comparisons with Stern, but this is before all of that. These are guys who would yell people down while they were calling, and I started to zone in on the fact that they wanted the callers to be like bad callers so that they could give the guy a really hard time, because that was entertaining for the listeners, and that the listeners and the callers are really two different groups of people. And that started the road on toward this talk radio thing. I do listen to talk radio a little bit now. Occasionally, if I'm on a long distance ride, I often listen to Rush Limbaugh more than anybody else, because I am fascinated by the phenomenon of Rush Limbaugh.
How much of that do you think is a performance on his part?
It's all a performance. And I think that that needs to be – it's interesting because at one point he embraced the notion of himself as an entertainer and he said, I don't really have anything to say. And, I'm not – the point is it's a show. And then more recently he has said that that isn't what he's about and he's taking this more active political position. But the truth of the matter is the man has become fabulously wealthy, manipulating political ideas, which is – if it had no effect on the world, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to step out of myself here as a writer and talking about my book and everything, but this is something I feel strongly about. If it had nothing to do with the world at large, fine. Let him talk about whatever he wants. If he wanted to talk about – I can't imagine what it is that would be a hot button that doesn't have an effect on the world. But in this man's case, he cheer-led this country into a war and people died. A lot of people died as a result, and I think that it's incredibly callous what he did, and I absolutely judge it and look down on it. As a man gets rich, he's a drug addict, and he goes by promoting war, and he does it with – I think he does it – butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. I think it's all some kind of ridiculous game that – let's let Rush off the hook for a second and just say that the actual technology of the mass media has created a position where somebody can and will do this, just like there are ball players who make $20 million a year. Somebody's going to make $20 million a year in the radio business if they're willing to take that position. And it requires some kind of skill, but I think it's incredibly irresponsible.
Should some of the culpability lie with the people who listen to anybody who tells them what to think and they just take that and walk away with it?
Well, that's the odd thing about the way some of these things work. Just like I will be listening to Rush as I'm driving down from Boston to New York and thinking, well, I don't buy anything this guy's saying, but I'm going to listen to it anyway. I think a lot of people listen to it thinking he's talking to somebody but not me. I'm just going to kind of – this is kind of, which is the entertainment part of it. I mean, just the way he manipulates his voice is entertaining. I know how to do that too. And that whole up and down and all that kind of stuff. He just pulls that out of his hat and it makes it very listenable. And then you never know what clever thing he's going to come up with. He's funny. He can put a funny spin on things. They went after, was it Al Gore or Kerry or somebody for eating a – remember, he went on for like a half hour because the guy had – he was eating a Philly steak sandwich the wrong way in Philly. And this was just – and it's amazing how long he can go on with ragging a guy about something as dumb as that. So it's entertaining. But I think I'd say that probably 75% of the people who are listening to him probably don't share his extreme – the beliefs he's claiming to be espousing or that he – embraces.
Let's go to Danny in Grapevine. Hey, Danny.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I was just listening to where he was talking about living in his fantasy, pretending a lot. Well, I had older brothers and sisters that were much older than I was, so I was kind of by myself, and I did it a lot. I always thought that it brought the artistic part of the person out. I thought everyone had it.
That's a great point. I think that everyone. I worked with an artist named Vic Muniz, MUNEZ. And if you don't know this guy's work, go on your computer and look him up because he makes the most amazing and funny art. He's a wonderful artist who works out of Brooklyn. And I was somewhere where he was being interviewed. And they said, when did you decide to become an artist? And he said, it isn't when I decided to become an artist. I decided to remain an artist. Every child starts out as an artist and then gets taught to not be an artist anymore. And the fantasy, that's what's great about not only being an actor but being an audience at a live performance or anything where you get to – or to read a book where you're really using your fantasy mind very, very actively, and it's really exciting as opposed to zoning out. I'm sorry, TV pays my bills, but I do think TV is too much TV can kind of, I don't know, about rot your mind, but it puts you in such a passive place. It takes care of all the fantasy part. You're not fantasizing. You're not actively filling in the spaces when you're watching a TV, but you read a book. You read my book, you're going to have a whole different set of images, for instance, of New York in the 70s, which is a big part of the book, than the next person, because that's you're like in a fantasy union with the writer as you're reading the book. And the same, I think, is true when you go to the theater and you see a live performance.
Why do you think so many people are so content to sit in front of a TV for 3, 4, 5 hours a night?
Oh, I just think TV is like probably like drugs, that it, you know, however we evolved as the kind of primates we are, we enjoy watching. And TV presents us with an opportunity to do it a lot, just like, you know, you can go down the store and buy, you know, a gallon of ice cream and take it. And if you don't stop yourself, you could sit there and eat the whole gallon of ice cream. I mean, an ape will do that, and a chimpanzee will sit there and eat the ice cream until it's gone. And they'll watch each other. They've done experiments on apes watching each other through one-way mirrors. And so they're just endlessly – they'll just never stop watching. Kind of that's what you're doing when you're watching TV, I think.
Let's go next to Pete in Arlington. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, Eric, compliments to you on your role in Law & Order. I'm an absolute Law & Order addict. I've watched that program since the get-go, and I love it.
Thank you. Keep me employed.
You almost answered the question I called to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway and see if you elaborate a little further. On the production side, you're very involved in multiple facets of production. You're an author of novels. You're a playwright. And you're an actor. On the consumption end, you know, people can buy books, they can go to a play, they can watch TV, or go to a movie. And so really my question is, how do you view this obvious movement towards digitized entertainment, more visual entertainment? And I know sometimes it's easy to be critical of too much TV, et cetera, and not enough reading. But I'll just close with this comment and then take your answer off the air. I love to read. I read a lot about the Civil War. I learned more watching Ken Burns' special on the Civil War than I learned from all the books I read about the Civil War. So I'll take your answer offline. And, again, thank you for your contribution on Law & Order.
No, thank you. Thanks so much. Well, look, we're moving into the realm of sociology here or something, and I don't know that I'm any more expert than the next guy. But to go back to the ice cream analogy, I like ice cream, and I'm not going to stop eating ice cream. I just don't eat a whole gallon of it at a time. And I think there's been some – I think actually a lot of TV has been improving lately. Some of my – in fact – I'll take TV dramas on cable over. I watch them on disc. I don't have TV, but I will rent The Wire or Sopranos or something. I think the acting and the drama and the writing on those things is better than I've seen in a lot of movies lately. So there's some very high quality stuff. And as you mentioned, Burns, there's been more and more good documentary work. So. You know, I'm not going to put it down. I just think that the position of the viewer to the set or to the cathode ray tube in the case of a computer, it's so passive. And not only do I think that engagement with the world in a physically active way, in a mentally active way, is important, but also the spaces in between are important too. To be constantly being infused with a stream of stimulation, that's also not necessarily good. It's important that you walk somewhere and think about things a little bit, or maybe go to a play and have there be moments in the play where nothing's really happening that's really just thrilling you, and you kind of go into this meditative state. I think all of that's very good for just being human, that our natural tendency is to be engaged. There's an ecology. We worry about some fish in the desert somewhere that's in a little pool of water and it's going extinct because it doesn't have things the way it should be. Humans have put themselves in environments that are very bad for humans, and we need to think about what's going to make us thrive and be happiest.
I know that you're beyond that place in your career where you have to take whatever role is offered to you as an actor, or else you don't eat or you don't pay the rent or whatever. But I'm wondering if working as a writer for so many years makes it much harder for you to cope with a script that for whatever reason just isn't working.
Yeah. That's true.
What do you do?
I'm a pain in the neck to the writers on our show, hopefully in a good, constructive way. But if something isn't working, I'm going to tell them. Now, a lot of actors are certainly star actors. would, and I'm not the star of these shows, but I'm a lead on the show. They will throw in their two cents maybe too often and drive the writers crazy. So they have this sort of thing where they sort of move into their shell the minute they hear the actor starting to tell them something about their line. But I do know something about writing. I've written many teleplays and screenplays, and you know, I'll explain myself to the writer why I think something is working or not working. I definitely cannot do scripts that don't work for me, and that's my first thing to look at is the writing. Now, in the case of Law and Order, I mean, that's my job now. I'm on contract there, so it's an ongoing process of looking at scripts. But if I were given a film script years ago, I got a call from my manager, and she said, I have something, I want to put something to you, but don't talk. She said, okay, now, first of all, it's a movie. It's a Steven Seagal movie. Wait, stop. It's a Steven Seagal movie. It's a sequel. Wait, that, you know. But I didn't care about any of that. I said, send me the script. Let me read it. And I ended up doing this movie, Under Siege 2. And to my great delight, I really had a great time doing it. And it was structurally sound. The idea of it. I also got to work with the director quite a bit on it in terms of thinking it through as we were making the film for Warner Brothers. But writing is the fundamental place. That's where it starts with all of this stuff.
Does every script that ends up making a good film read well when you first get a copy of it?
I actually am not the best reader in the world. I know when I read something that I like that it speaks to me, but I will admit to making mistakes on scripts and not understanding that this is a script that I should I just may not get what the writer's doing. You know, younger, new writers in the scene, they may be writing more descriptive passages, less dialogue, or they just, you know, if it's a really groundbreaking script, it may have elements that are just all new to me that I have never seen before. Got to stay open-minded.
Eric Bogosian is a writer and actor. His new novel is called Perforated Heart. Eric, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.